All right, so tonight I'd like to go a different direction in how we've gone through the class. So much of the class we've been learning really how to cultivate this technique of meditation. Or another way to say it, we're developing a different relationship to our own internal experience, our sensations of our body, of our hearts, of our minds, and learning to find a place of steadiness and balance. And as people have talked about in those comments and sharing, that sometimes it's very helpful when our minds are anxious, when we're feeling a sense of discomfort in our bodies, learning how to find a place of groundedness, of centeredness, and how to deal with the external irritations and difficulty of the world. So this is all such a valuable gift we give ourselves. And the more we're able to cultivate that, we naturally start to give that to other people. And you may find that loved ones and friends, notice that you're maybe more attentive, you're less reactive from the result of your good efforts on this class and this practice. And so that being said, naturally, once we start to cultivate this inner relationship with ourselves, we start to look at how can we act in the world? How can we act in a way that really reflects our understanding and our own inner growing wisdom. Because when we practice, we start to learn this sensitivity into our own inner experience. So, for example, if I'm going to say, let's say I'm going to say something that's untrue, to say a lie, the more I practice, the more I can feel that dissonance inside of me. I can feel that kind of things not quite being lined up, that tightness, that shame or that fear or whatever it might be. And often I can feel it much clearer, more clearly in my body than in the stories my mind might say. My mind might rationalize why it's okay to say something that's untrue, but the body has its own resonance. And that way we start to have this different relationship to how we act in the world. One meditation teacher named Ruth Denison said that once you start to practice, you start to find that you can't get away with anything because that sensitivity starts to grow. Your meditation gives you this awareness of where that dissonance is. So this is all in a way of introducing this topic tonight, which is what's called the five precepts. The five precepts, or you could talk about ethical behavior. And when I say something like ethics or morality, sometimes we're like, oh boy, didn't sign up for this, or you feel that resistance. And a nice way to practice with it is not as a external authority telling you, do this or don't do that, because if you do, there's something bad will happen. But instead, approach it from your own inner authority, your own inner wisdom, and how you start to cultivate this. You start to really feel the dissonance in your body when you're about to do something that might be harmful to another person. So these five precepts, this is kind of one of the foundations of the Buddhist teaching. He would often teach with these three main roots. One is the meditation, what's called the bhavana, the cultivation of meditative insight, of meditative wisdom, to allow us to really deepen to our experience. That starts to show us, allows to shift from this kind of self-centered perspective. Another aspect he would often teach, was kind of the three foundations, was generosity. The sense of when we come from a, let's say, not a generous heart, when we're really contracted within ourselves, we naturally, it's much harder to act. We reinforce that sense of separation. So, practicing generosity allows us to acknowledge that interconnection, acknowledge that sense of how we support each other, whether it's our actions of our time, our money, or whatever it might be. And the third one was of the precepts or ethics. And just as we are kind of connection that comes from generosity, there's also this sense of caring for other people's well-being and our own well-being. So these five precepts, we'll go through them and explore them a little bit. Really, if we take them on, they benefit not only everybody that we encounter, but also benefit ourselves. Because the more that we're living a life that's based in non-harm, and in kindness, we naturally start to have an inner stillness that starts to grow. Conversely, you know, if we're acting from a place of harm, there's often a turbulence inside. There's an unrest. There's lots of thoughts as we're trying to find a way to hide or overcome what we've done to navigate that. And so these precepts, you can start to notice, again, that inner authority when you start to bump up against them. You can feel that internal noise. And then when you follow the precepts, there's often a sense of ease, a sense of calmness, a sense of quiet that arises instead. Now, these precepts are often phrased as undertaking the training to refrain from. So isn't that interesting? Undertaking the training to refrain from. So there's an acknowledgement that this is a practice, that we are human, that we do fail at these things. And to understand that there's this refraining from versus, you know, shalt not. It's a very different language. And that allows us to have this very deeper understanding or seeing of our kind of inner motivation, our inner things which are arising. As someone said in the questions, I think it was Clay who was talking about noticing, like with social media, how we see the media, you know, there's this impulse to kind of overcome something, like a sense of loneliness or a sense of lack, and how that tries to fulfill it. As we start to be able to observe that more and more and pause, we start to see how our actions are always preceded by some impulse like that. And meditation gives us this gift of kind of slowing down those impulses, because usually we're just acting, and the impulse arises and we're acting right away from it. Slowing down allows us to start to observe it and reflect, you know, is this really what I want to be doing? Is this really helpful? And a key component of this is to really have this deep friendliness for what your inner experience. Okay, so often we're taught to not have that. We're taught to judge parts of ourselves. We judge those parts that we are ashamed of, like our lust, our greed, our hatred, those kind of qualities. And as a meditator, you got to start to see those arise, and you may be, you know, red-faced when those arise or shame-faced when those arise. But you start to realize seeing them actually means I'm not being driven by them, that I have a choice. Once I see them, I'm able to actually choose to act or not act from them. If I repress them and push them down, I'm much more likely to come out in a sideways way. And this is one of the downsides of people who, you know, are particularly perhaps religious or spiritual, is that they have this idea in their minds of what that spiritual person or religious person should be. And when their inner experience doesn't match that, there's a huge amount of tension that arises. So hopefully from the very beginning, you got the sense of, at the meditation technique, it doesn't matter what's arising in your experience, whether it's a breath, a sensation, a thought that you're ashamed of, you can all be observed. And actually just resting in that observation itself doesn't mean you have to act from it. In fact, it helps you not act from it, or choose to act from things which are helpful, which are kind, which are generous. So be willing to look inside, you know, be more and more sensitive to those inner things which arise. Not having any agenda or any sense of should or shouldn't, but just see what is here. And trusting that seeing itself then provides this beautiful platform for action to arise that's really truly helpful. It's not harmful. Because we can't really change how the emotions are arising, the reactions are arising. We can work with how we relate to them and how we act from them. You know, what arises, you know, it's not our fault what arises, but how we meet that, how we act is our responsibility. So let's explore these five precepts. The Buddha liked to, you know, the whole tradition likes to have these numbers. There's the fives of these and the sevens of those, the 12s and the 4s and things like that, the 3s. Lots of lists. So the first hindrance is to refrain from killing or harming living beings. Right? So, and again, I'm saying these not as to try to convert you into Buddhism. You'll find that these are actually commonly held in whatever religious faith you may have. I completely honor and respect that. It's more just this is how we live well together, and trying to build it and bring it into this meditative perspective. So refrain from killing or harming living beings. So recall that talk on the hindrances, and particularly the aversion, the not wanting, the movement away from experience. So harming and killing is part of that whole spectrum. You know, killing is, of course, way down that. But how often do we just discount some aspects of living creatures? I mean, how many of us have slapped down on the mosquito without even giving any kind of reflection that, oh, I'm going to take someone's life, even though it's an insect that might be biting me? There's still that aversion, and we act from that. And so practicing pausing, say, okay, is there maybe another option of maybe just gently waving that mosquito away? This precept of refraining from killing and harming. I remember, I guess how long has it been now? My daughter's 17, so she was probably around 3 or 4. It's a while ago. We had some yellow jacket nest in our backyard, and I was worried about her getting stung and her, you know, young toddler friends being stung. So I wanted to get the nest to not be there, but I also wanted to follow this precept. So what I did is I decided to knock down the nest, you know, so hopefully not harm very many of them, and they would rebuild it someplace else. So I, being young and brave and fairly stupid, I knocked it down and ran away. And, you know, they were all angry, but they, you know, I thought, okay, I didn't get stung. But they liked that spot, so they build the nest right back in the same spot. So I'm embarrassed to say this, but even being, you know, again, a little stupid and foolhardy, I thought, well, okay, maybe I'll relocate the nest. So somehow I thought the idea, I'll put a garbage can underneath the nest, knock it down, and then put a can or a lid over it and take it to a remote part of the local park and release them, you know, catch and release. Didn't get stung. I don't know how I did manage that. But they came back, you know, even though it was like, you know, a quarter mile away. And so finally, after those, you know, there was trying my best, I decided, okay, I'm going to have to get that, the can of Raid. And, you know, but as I did that, I had a very different relationship to killing those creatures. I could really feel the impact. I could feel the remorse. I could feel, you know, I could not get away with that experience. I really felt it, even though I still had to make that choice. At least that's what it felt like in that moment. I've done that. Yeah, also like when the roofers came, you know, I didn't want them to get stung by a yellow jacket nest underneath the roof line. But there's also this, it's really having my eyes fully open, not just discounting another creature. So I tell this story just to give a sense of how we can work with this non-killing. And I think for many of us, it's, you know, the insects that forms of life that we just discount, that we can start to bring some interest to. And of course, I like to add harming and the ways, kind of subtle ways we cause harm or killing to ourselves, and how we, you know, just take a sample of your self-talk, you know, your inner critic, and how harmful that is. And if you quieted that down, if you didn't add to that, how much more stillness, how much more peace there would be in you, your external critic. So refraining from harming and killing living beings. The next one is to refrain from taking that which isn't freely given, from stealing, refraining from stealing. And going back to the hindrances, this is often driven by craving, that sense of inner lack. And I want to try to fulfill that in some way. You know, I get that pause that Clay was talking about, pausing, you can feel that impulse to move toward. And then you have the choice of just meeting that, simply being with that impulse. And even that, you can, underneath that, you can start to feel the lack that's driving that. Now, sometimes it's interesting with a lot of these precepts, and this one I think I've noticed in my own self, how you can rationalize anything. You can rationalize, okay, it's okay to take those extra things that no one's going to notice, or I do extra work and I don't get paid for it. So I rationalize that whole thing. I remember, here's an example. Like if you were, back, remember when we used to be able to have samples in grocery stores before COVID? And, how many of us have kind of swung by a tasty sample a couple of times? Like, oh, I think I'll try a little bit more of that, not quite sure when I buy it or not. And, but it's like, that's not really what's freely offered. It's like, okay, try one. If you like it, then get some more. But there's that kind of play with that, the rationalization. I remember, a long time ago before I started to practice working for an agency and doing a lot of extra unpaid time and kind of using that to justify basically stealing some maps or some other things from the, extra paper or something. It's like my mind kind of rationalized it. And that's it. When you pause and you feel yourself, okay, I'm about to kind of reach for something, pause and just notice the internal reaction. And often when you choose to not take, not steal, to not take which is not freely given or offered, it may feel unpleasant in the moment, but there's also this sense of settling. Like, okay, all right, I'm landing here. I'm really feeling my feet. And that's a good discernment to start to notice. The choice that goes into a non-ethical or a harmful action, there's a turbulence, a noise that's generated. Going into a quiet, a sense of what's non-harm or non-stealing, there's a quiet that comes with that. And you start to really value and cherish that quiet more than whatever the substance or the idea or the thing is you hope to give you. So it becomes more and more of a kind of a positive feedback loop. You start to see that, this does bring more calm to me, does bring more ease to me. And I remember when I really started to take this precept on, going on a meditation retreat and just feeling that sense of caring for everyone there, caring to not take their possessions, to allow them to relax that. And for me to relax, not to have to worry about hiding my stuff, that fear that we often carry. It was a gift. It's a gift that you give when you take this on. And people start to sense that in you. There's a way that they relax too. So refraining from taking that which isn't freely given. So the third precept is to refrain from sexual misconduct, from sexual harm, the ways that we harm others through our sexuality or through our, this of course has a wide range from, very mild and subtle to, of course, the much more sexual violence and assault that perhaps some of us have experienced, the abuse. This is often also driven by the hindrance of craving or that sense of lack, that wanting, that lust. Sometimes it's the movement away from the pain of a reality. When we get caught in a sex addiction or that sense of craving, wanting something. I remember seeing this advertisement for this divorce attorney. And the attorney just had a couple torso shots of these very female and male torsos, just not even seeing their head, but just their chest area. And the message literally was, life is too short. Get a divorce and you can get what you want, kind of a thing was the message there. And how that really is such a strong drive in our culture. And I know many of us have been harmed, through sexual acts from other people, for our own acts. And you know how devastating that can be, that sense of the boundaries being violated. And there's also the subtle qualities of how we hold ourselves in gender roles, how we should be if we're, what boys do, what girls do. And these are all subtle ways we can play with that quality of non-sexual harm. And then sexuality is interesting, though, too, because it is a beautiful part of being human. When you're in a consenting relationship and a sense of loving relationship, it can be a very beautiful part of relationships. So it's not about not being sexual. There's sometimes if we go on a retreat, we take a vow of abstinence, abstinence for that retreat. Monks and nuns take vows of chastity, or not chastity, but celibacy. But for lay people, for people who are just, you know, practicing in their midst of their life, sexuality is certainly a wonderful part. So play with that, you know, as you're being sexual with yourself or with other people, feeling, okay, do I feel that sense of connection, that sense of heart? And also noticing when that's not there, and you know, how you might relate to someone just as a sexual being instead of who they are as a whole being. You know, seeing the whole person. So there's a sense of equality, a sense of equal sharing. So the third precept of refraining from sexual harm. Then the fourth precept is refraining from false speech, from lying. Now often, you know, why do we lie? Going back to those hindrances of aversion and craving. And I keep emphasizing that because the more we can identify that and see that as when that arises in a really quiet way, it allows us to kind of change the course of our action, change the trajectory of how we're going to be acting. Because often we lie to cover up something that we don't want to be seen. Or perhaps, you know, I'm ashamed about something about myself, or I'm embarrassed, and so I don't share it. So there's a sense of kind of bypassing or avoiding, you know, what's actually true. I remember feeling this with a friend who had a brain injury and started to act out in really strange ways and, you know, being more profane and angry. And, you know, hearing this from another person, then when I was talking to that person, just feeling this dissonance of seeing this person right in front of me and hearing this all this backstory, you know, and that sense of gossip and trying to connect with who that person is right there, not through my ideas and perceptions of them. So false speech or lying, there's also these elements of what's maybe gossip or not beneficial. Now, the Buddha talked about three main kind of gateways for speech in general. First one is that it's true, that, you know, it's actually aligned with what's actually true. This is different than what we think is true or our opinions. You know, there's a difference when we have those, you know, especially, you know, how things are these days with so much division. We have these strong opinions that feel very true, but is that really true? Or like the parable of the blind people with the elephant, and different, they all come from different angles in the elephant and touch a different part of the elephant. And they start to argue about what an elephant is like, never having experienced it. And some people are saying it's like, you know, it's like a long spear who's talking the trunk, or the one's like a big wavy leaf touching the ear, or like a snake touching the trunk or the tail or trunk of a tree. And they would argue about it. They all had their own experience, but it was a limited truth. So that first one, that sense of being true, holding that lightly, remembering all that we've learned about thought and how random thought is in our own minds. Hopefully you come away from this class with a little less enchantment with your thinking mind and a little bit more of a devotion to your feeling body. The second kind of gateway is this. Is this beneficial to share this? You know, is it beneficial to speak this truth? Because sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's harmful. It's not, the person's not able to hear it. Or sometimes the motivation is more for your own benefit instead of the other person's. And finally, the timing. You know, what's the right timing to talk and share this, what is here? And a good way to summarize this whole wise speech, refraining from false speech, is to speak from a kind heart. This goes back to that inner dissonance versus that inner alignment. We speak what's true from a kind heart, that's naturally there. Even though it might be difficult to share something personal, something sensitive, there's a sense of alignment that comes from that. And conversely, there's a noise, a sense of contraction that happens when we speak something that's untrue. And the final precept, is to refrain from substances that cloud the mind. from intoxication. So this is an interesting one. You know, in our society where, you know, many people enjoy alcohol or other substances. And to just highlight the phrase that lead to heedlessness. Okay, so substances that lead to heedlessness, that cloud the mind. So, you know, perhaps we know from our own experience or those that we love and care about, when we become intoxicated, it's much easier to harm. It's much easier to break all these precepts because we lose that contact with our own inner wisdom, with our own truth, with our own control of our impulses. Because this practice is really about learning to see clearly. You know, the word vipassana means to see clearly and to understand what's being seen. When we cloud our mind, we lose that contact. And so refraining from substances which cloud the mind. Now this one is held different ways, and you can, you know, certainly see how you want to hold it yourself. You know, all these are invitations, they're not like commandments or, you know, rules that I'm giving you. It's more invitations to look. And so, like, let's say you like to have a glass of wine with dinner, just noticing, okay, where's the clarity of mind and where's that start to change? If I have two glasses or more, I start to shift in that. Or like maybe there's that sense of looking for that substance to cloud my pain, to overcome that pain. Maybe there's a better way to meet that, to care for ourselves. So these five precepts, to refrain from harming and killing, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from sexual misconduct, sexual harm, to refrain from speaking what's untrue, to lying, and to refrain from substances which cloud the mind. These are all invitations to practice with and play with. Now, as you heard these, you may find some of them that you kind of felt a little bit of resistance toward. And those might be ones you might play with a little bit. Play with the subtle qualities of it, or maybe the not so subtle qualities, and just see what arises. And I encourage us to use that inner authority, you know, feeling that sense of quiet versus noise, that turbulence that's kicked up when we're kind of pushing against these precepts, and the quiet that comes when we follow them. And just to end, there's a quote by, often attributed to Viktor Frankl. There's some debate about whether he actually said it or not, but it's a beautiful quote, that between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So that is a beautiful way of talking about how we act in the world. The meditation gives us that space, that pause. And then we can see how we want to act. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. Meditation allows that space to become seen and spread out. And that space is our power, to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And just sit quietly for a few moments.